Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode on the Schema series. We have some clinical problem solvers here. I'm Mark, a hospitalist here at Stanford, and I have my great crew, my great Schema crew. How you doing, Maddie?
I'm doing great. Great to see you all. I'm super excited to present this case to you all. I have just about 2 to 3 weeks left of maternity leave, so kind of soaking in this time at home before jumping back to the wards. What about you, Noah? How are you doing?
Hey, everyone. I'm doing pretty good. Yesterday was my partner's first day at her new job, so I'm excited to kind of I'm waiting for her to get home so she can tell me everything that happened and all that. So excited for that. What about you, Yusuf?
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm good. I was just telling Noah that I'm getting physical therapy done for ACL surgery that I had. And I love physical therapy. It's like a workout. It's a positive relationship. You check the weights, you get stronger, you get better. And I now can confidently prescribe it to my patients and know that it's like a positive experience. So it's my PT journey.
Yeah, Yusuf, you know, I feel like I refer so many patients to PT, but I personally have not experienced it. So glad to hear that it's such a great thing.
Yeah, bring PTOT to VMR.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, guys. Well, I am so excited to present this case to you all. So I'm just going to jump right in. So this is a case I saw on my ICU rotation a few months ago. And basically, you know, you get called to come evaluate a patient in the emergency department. And the first pieces of information I hear is that this is a 79-year-old woman, and she was sent to the emergency department actually from an outpatient pulmonary hypertension clinic. So she presented to the outpatient pulmonary hypertension clinic for basically a new patient evaluation. She was there to establish care. But before she even had her appointment, she was using the restroom, and a rapid response was called when she was in the restroom for basically shortness of breath and a syncopal episode. So this rapid response was called. And so before she could even have this appointment, she was transferred to the emergency department for further workup. So Noah, maybe I'll pass the mic to you. Of course, you don't know too much information at this point, but you know, with these two things, like pulmonary hypertension clinic, syncope, how could those two things be related, and what's crossing your mind?
You know, that's a great introduction to the case, and I have learned this factoid during my ICU rotation that patients with pulmonary hypertension, they have to avoid doing Valsalva, and the reason behind it's kind of the same reasoning why we are so hesitant in using positive pressure to ventilate those patients, which is to increase their intrathoracic pressure and then kind of reduce their preload. And they're very preload state dependent with the pulmonary hypertension and the likely right-sided heart failure. So it's very good that she Valsalva'd and syncopized, you know, in the clinic where there were people able to help her. And I'm very worried because to me, that's a marker of pretty advanced disease. Of course, we have to do our due diligence and kind of exonerate other causes of syncope. But I think for me, that would be a pretty convincing story for severe pulmonary hypertension causing syncope with increased intrathoracic pressure. What do you think so far, Mark?
Yeah, I think, you know, all of you guys have probably experienced this, that I feel like, you know, when you're a resident and taking care of patients with pulmonary hypertension, like that's kind of like the disease that everyone's the most scared of, because these patients can go from 0 to 100 really, really fast. And there's even that term like the RV death spiral, right? And it's interesting, though, like we learned that, like, you know, pulmonary hypertension, these patients are preload dependent, like, you know, be careful when you're doing positive pressure ventilation, be careful diuresing them because you don't want to make that RV, you know, really small and deplete their preload. But then you'll talk to pulmonary hypertension doctors, and essentially the recommendation they give you every single time when this patient has severe pulmonary hypertension is decompensated is diurese, diurese, diurese. Pulmonary hypertension doctors are much more aggressive with diuresis than we are. And the really it is because while they are preload dependent, and while if you Valsalva and decrease your preload and you syncopize, that usually means that your RV is doing pretty bad and there's pretty high pulmonary pressures. If your RV is so dilated and so decompensated, that RV starts to bow into the LV and then starts to cause, you know, decreased perfusion to the systemic circulation. So that's why really one of the mainstays of treatment is diuresis, because you want to prevent that bowing of the RV into the LV. So it's this really delicate balance. That's why a lot of times these patients are such a low threshold for these patients to be in the cardiac ICU or the medical ICU when, you know, you're having you have an arterial line in them and keeping a really close eye on their pressures. And they're really tough patients to manage. But Yusuf, I'm curious, when you think of like a new patient with pulmonary hypertension, really all we have now is the age. How do you stratify the differential diagnosis based on the age? Does that help you at all?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that, Mark. And before I get there, I was hoping to talk about syncope as well, because we teach the schema of syncope as in reflex, orthostatic, and cardiac. And this is for all comers of syncope is a good framework. But one thing that we leave out of this framework is that any cause of shock in its early form can also cause syncope. And that is implied, and I would love to like just say that out loud. So, and the causes of shock, you can spell out shock. So S is in septic, H is hypovolemic or hemorrhagic, O is obstructive, and C is cardiogenic. So in any patient with syncope, so in addition to the big buckets of reflex, orthostatic, and cardiac, you're thinking of any cause of shock. And there's a big overlap here between cardiac and obstructive. So we're thinking, is this like a right-sided pressure phenomenon? And Mark, to answer your question, I think the age is really helpful. And the other thing that's really helpful is the center of attention. We didn't hear from Maddie that this patient presented to a heart failure clinic for lower extremity edema. We didn't hear from Maddie that this patient presented for a COPD to a pulmonologist. We heard that they presented to a pulmonary hypertension clinic. And the vast majority of cases are going to be related to cardiac disease or obvious pulmonary disease. But the fact that they presented to a pulmonary hypertension clinic has me worried about more esoteric causes. And I'll leave it at that and would love to hear more from Maddie.
Beautiful discussion. So let me tell you more. So when I get to go interview her in the emergency department, on history, she says that even before the syncopal episode in the bathroom, she's had basically progressive fatigue, shortness of breath, and lower extremity edema really preceding the past month. And when asking a little bit more about this syncopal episode, she reports in the past 1 to 2 months, she's actually had several episodes that she described as blacking out. And so that was kind of the main history that she described to me. The past medical history I was able to gather from her and from the chart is that she has chronic hypoxemic respiratory failure on 5 liters at baseline. She also has AFib status post an ablation on a DOAC. She has hypertension, and her chart says OSA, but she's never had a sleep study and she's not on CPAP. And then in terms of her, you know, I was looking like, why were you in the pulmonary hypertension clinic? So basically she was referred basically like 1 month before this current presentation. She was hospitalized at an outside hospital for basically an acute on chronic hypoxemic respiratory failure and right-sided heart failure. During that previous hospitalization, she was diuresed and she was referred to this pulmonary hypertension clinic for further workup. You know, I was digging through the chart and I see that basically she was diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension based on a right heart cath around 4 years ago or so. But the etiology of her pulmonary hypertension has been unclear. So, and some of the notes are kind of contradictory. So some of the notes are documenting this concern for WHO group two or three, whereas other notes document a concern for PAH. I'll get into kind of like her right heart cath maybe in a later subsequent aliquots. But I see that from a chart, from her chart, that she was actually started on sildenafil 2 months prior to admission because a most recent right heart cath was kind of concerning for group one. And then medications, I mentioned the DOAC, and she's on Lasix 40 milligrams daily, sildenafil, and those are really all of her pertinent medications. And really no pertinent social history. She was a former nurse. She lives with her family. No relevant like exposures and no drug or alcohol use. So maybe I'll pause there. And Yusuf, I think at this point it might be helpful to just, focus a little bit on the fundamentals, like how is pulmonary hypertension diagnosed? And maybe we can dive into how you all think about the causes.
Absolutely. And great aliquot, Maddie. And hearing things out loud, I'm still trying to label the problem. And we heard about a possible diagnosis of pulmonary hypertension. We heard about lower extremity edema. And then we heard a lot about cardiometabolic risk factors. In general, when I heard about the lower extremity edema, the thing that came up to my mind is this is an evidence of right-sided disease, so right-sided heart disease. And I would be hesitant to label this just heart failure. Instead, I would label it specifically as right-sided disease because we only heard about edema so far. We didn't hear about pulmonary edema, only some in the lower extremity. So, and then that makes the pulmonary artery potentially the center of attention of the case here. The patient is at risk for HFpEF. And what is HFpEF? So it's heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And we used to think in the past that high blood pressure causes LV hypertrophy and that alone causes HFpEF. But now we think of it as a cardiometabolic disease that occurs in females who are older than 70 with risk factors such as AFib, higher BMI, diabetes and hypertension and et cetera. But the fact that we don't hear about any left-sided symptoms is making me think is the pulmonary artery the center of attention of the case. And before I talk about the etiologies, Noah, I would love to hear about how you think about the anatomy of pulmonary arterial disease. And do you have an approach? And I know you love to take us through the journey of blood vessels, et cetera. I know you did it last time for our episode.
Actually, Yusuf, I don't think about pulmonary hypertension in an anatomical way. I have a much more pragmatic approach of pulmonary hypertension because I have found that we'll talk about this in further aliquots, but the way we classify pulmonary hypertension is in the WHO groups, so group 1 through 5, and that's kind of based on mechanisms and etiologies. And then on the right heart cath, you classify it based if it's pre-capillary, if it's combined pre and post, or if it's post-capillary. But all of them are kind of not very intuitive to me because you can have group 1 having the same right heart cath as group 2, in group 3 and so forth. So there's kind of like a lot of mixed data. So that's not the way I approach it. I have a pretty more management approach to pulmonary hypertension, if that makes any sense. So once I see that the patient has pulmonary hypertension, I say, okay, do they have left heart disease? Because that's kind of the first big etiology. Do they have any pulmonary disease? Because that's the second one. Do they have any risk factors for CTEF? And then the VQ scan has great sensitivity for picking up that etiology. And if not, then I start diving into the serological workup of pulmonary hypertension. That's the way I think about it. What about you, Mark? Are you a fan of the anatomical approach or more like the management approach?
I think I like both. Honestly, I love thinking about physiology and anatomy, but then I think the five groups or more of the management approach helps me kind of get to those etiologies more quickly. So I probably stick with the five groups more commonly than I do the anatomy and physiology approach. But I think both are great. I think one of the things that's really tough about pulmonary hypertension and what can lead to a lot of diagnostic errors, it comes down to the law of proportionality, right? We talk about this a lot in CP solvers, is that left heart disease is really common. Lung disease like COPD is really common. Pulmonary embolisms are really common, right? So I think it's really easy to say, oh, this patient has pulmonary hypertension from their HFpEF. The patient has pulmonary hypertension from their COPD. Oh, they had a prior PE. Maybe they have CTEF, and kind of stop the workup there. And I've seen patients get misdiagnosed with group two or group three and wind up having group one PAH and really not be started on therapy or start on therapy much later in their course than they should have and kind of suffered some consequences, unfortunately. So I think it's very important to be like, okay, if we're saying this patient is group two, let's say, is there a HFpEF that severe to lead to this severe pulmonary hypertension? Is there COPD or, you know, hypoxemia, like in proportion to the degree of their pulmonary hypertension? Those questions aren't, you know, always easy to answer, but I think it's something you have to think about before you label someone as group two or group three. Again, because these diagnoses are just so, so common. I think the one thing that stuck out to me is I'm like, whoa, why is this patient on 5 liters at baseline? Like, what is going on there, right? Maddie put in our chat that this patient has a BMI of 26, but we don't have really a past medical history of chronic lung disease. But, you know, obviously chronic hypoxemia certainly can lead to pulmonary hypertension. And we need to explain why this patient is on 5 liters of oxygen. Like, I need a high resolution CT chest immediately to see if this patient has interstitial lung disease or just, you know what is going on with their lungs that's leading to be, you know, chronically hypoxemic at 5 liters. I think the one other misnomer too is pulmonary hypertension does not or rarely leads to hypoxemia, right? Hypoxemia can result in pulmonary hypertension, but the reverse is not commonly seen, right? Pulmonary hypertension, like PEs, is more of a hemodynamic disease, right? When pulmonary hypertension gets severe, the RV starts failing, people get cardiogenic shock before they really get hypoxemia. I've seen patients like, oh, patient with pulmonary hypertension comes to the hospital with hypoxemia. Oh, it's probably just from the pulmonary hypertension. That is not true. It's a very late stage finding. And what I was taught by one of my ICU residents, my intern year, is that the mechanism really is a low mixed venous oxygen saturation. So what that means is that when the pulmonary hypertension gets so, so severe, the lungs just try to extract as much oxygen as they can because you're not getting a lot of blood flow through the capillaries. And that leads to a low mixed venous sat on the other side. And that can eventually lead to hypoxemia. But again, that is a very, very late stage finding. So all of my energy right now is like, what is going on with those lungs? What else do you have for us, Maddie?
All right. Great discussion. So I'll share the next aliquot here. So in the emergency department, when I go down to see her, her vitals, her blood pressure is 140s over 100s. Her pulse is in the 80s to 90s. Her respiratory rate was 16. And when I went to go see her, she was on her baseline of 5 liters. And I'll kind of comment on those 5 liters. It was also kind of interesting to us because initially when looking through the chart, it was not clear what that was secondary to. So that was also kind of a question mark in our mind. So on physical exam, what was most notable is she had jugular venous distension to her earlobe. She had lower extremity pitting edema, even like past her knees, like up into her thighs. Her belly was generally soft, non-tender, non-distended. She was sitting in bed, able to answer questions there with her son, and was not in like significant kind of respiratory distress when I went to go see her. And actually when listening to her lungs, there were no obvious abnormal breath sounds, like no obvious crackles, no rails that I heard. And kind of no obvious rashes on extremity exam. So for her labs, her CBC was unremarkable. Her BMP, most notable for a creatinine of 2.27 from a baseline of 1.4. Her BNP was 5,000. And her lactate, the first one was 7.8. TSH was normal. I'll give you a little bit more work up here. So chest x-ray on admission commented on a small left pleural effusion and an enlarged cardiomediastinal silhouette. And then looking kind of past in her chart, she had a CTPE 1 month prior at that earlier admission that actually showed a normal appearing lung parenchyma and no pulmonary embolism. And she had a transthoracic echocardiogram also during that last admission that had an EF of 55%. It commented on the right ventricle being enlarged, the RV systolic function was reduced, the right atrium was enlarged, and had ventricular septal flattening consistent with RV pressure or volume overload. It also commented on severe tricuspid regurgitation on that echo. On that TTE, there was an estimated PA systolic pressure of 71. Also, kind of digging through her chart, I see that she had pulmonary function testing 3 months before this admission that had normal spirometry, but an isolated low DLCO. So ultimately, she was admitted. She was started on IV diuresis. And we held her sildenafil, given the concern that it may have been worsening her symptoms. I can tell you a little bit more about, maybe I'll pause there, and then I can comment a little bit on some of the like serologic testing that had previously been done into her pulmonary hypertension. Mark, that was a lot of data, but I'm going to pass the mic to you just to hear your general thoughts, and then maybe we can pass the mic to Yusuf to give an overview of the WHO classes.
Awesome. Yeah, this is a really rich aliquot, Maddie. But I took a deep breath, and there's definitely a sigh of relief when I see these vital signs. Anytime I was admitting a patient with pulmonary hypertension, that seems a little tenuous. Like I get worried. Oh, they're going to be hypotensive. You know, these patients can crash really quickly, like I said, with that RV death spiral. But luckily, we have a decent blood pressure, even on a little bit on the higher side. The patient isn't tachycardic. They're saturating 96% on their baseline 5 liters. That hopefully we're going to find an answer to. At some point, but not really overly surprised by the exam. Not surprised by the elevated JVD, given the patient's pulmonary hypertension and the echo that was given. The patient seems very overloaded from a pitting edema perspective. They have edema even up to their bilateral thighs, but again, they're volume overloaded. And then we see the CBC is normal, which is good. The BNP again, the creatinine not overly surprising. They have an AKI. A creatinine of 2.27 from their baseline of 1.4. Really, the most common reason that a patient would volume overload, this could be from left heart failure, this could be from right heart failure. The most common reason they would have an AKI on admission is cardiorenal syndrome, right? This patient's pulmonary pressure is presumably extremely high and are essentially just strangling the renal vein, right? So that perfusion pr pressure to the kidney is severely reduced, so you're going to get an AKI. And usually with diuresis, they just get better, right? But in someone like this, I know the numbers look okay, but you can have normotensive cardiogenic shock, right? And that's something you have to think about every time you have a patient with severe pulmonary hypertension is like, is this patient tipping into cardiogenic shock? If that creatinine doesn't get better with diuresis, if this patient starts to have cool extremities and narrow pulse pressure, we're going to have to think about early inotropic support for this patient too. And that really, that kind of blends well with the lactate, right? So Maddie said this lactate was 7.8 and improved to 3.2 at diuresis. I'll say, going back to the law of proportionality, this lactate of 7.8 is way out of proportion to this patient's hemodynamics. Even if they have a normotensive cardiogenic shock, there is no way that is solely driving a lactate of 7.8. A lactate of 7.8, if you guys just, seeing a lot of lactates during residency, like that's like a lactate sometimes you get when a patient's like during a code, like it's extremely high lactate. But it's important to remember not all lactic acidosis is from hyperperfusion, right? There's kind of type A and type B. Type A is kind of perfusion related. It's the most common reason we see an elevated lactate, and it's any of your causes of shock can cause a type A lactic acidosis. One thing I can see missed sometimes is that you can have systemic hyperperfusion, like I mentioned, from sepsis or cardiogenic shock. But then you want to think about local hyperperfusion can also lead to an elevated lactate. And sometimes we see that with like mesenteric ischemia or like compartment syndrome. So it's not just global, it can be from localized. But we're not really getting a flavor of anything, global systemic hyperperfusion or local that would lead to this degree of lactate elevation. So I kind of have my antennas up for type B lactic acidosis, which has a lot of mechanisms. The thing I'll bring up here is something called the Warburg effect that you can see with cancers. And the reason I bring that up is that, you know, this patient had a widened cardiac silhouette. Now, that could just because their pulmonary trunk is huge, right? But, you know, this patient could have some sort of mediastinal mass, right? Like some sort of like the terrible T's, right? Like lymphoma or all the other like causes of an anterior mediastinal mass. And I would say the forgotten category of pulmonary hypertension is group 4, which we think about CTEP, but it's really anything that causes pulmonary artery obstruction. And that could be external or internal. So there's cases of, you know, lymphoma in the mediastinum that's just compressing on the pulmonary vasculature, leading to pulmonary hypertension. Now, you might have thought, you know, you probably would see that on the prior CTPE, but again, this is just like another hospital's imaging, and there's probably not that much data. So I'd be very curious if this, you know, mediastinal widening is just from the, you know, enlarged pulmonary trunk, or is there something actually compressing the pulmonary arteries leading to pulmonary hypertension? And again, the only reason I'm elaborating on that is just because I think this lactate is just like way too high, and I don't want to miss a type B cause of lactic acidosis for cancers. Commonly liquid cancers can do that. But, you know, again, Maddie said it improved with diuresis. So that's a signal that maybe it was more of a hemodynamic issue. But again, I don't love that lactate of 7.8. I don't want to blame it just solely on a hemodynamic issue. But I rambled a lot. I think Yusuf's going to talk about the five groups of pulmonary hypertension. So take it away, Yusuf.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I loved your note on normotensive shock, really easy to miss. One thing to note is if you want to, like, if you're listening, you can Google pulmonary hypertension drawing, and that's a quick way, like a mnemonic to remember it. So group one, if you put two ones next to each other, it looks like an artery. So it's pulmonary arterial hypertension. Group two, it's if you flip two twos next to each other, it looks like a heart. So it's left-sided heart disease. Group three is lung disease. Group four is CTEF, and group five is the bucket. And to simplify it even further, you can also think about it anatomically. So think about the RV, the pulmonary artery, and then going into the arterioles, the capillaries, and then all the way to the left ventricle. And one way you quickly want to think about this is this the lung? So we hear that the CT of the chest has normal lung findings, so that's very reassuring. It could still be like OSA-OHS, but we hear that the patient's BMI is 26, not extremely high. So that's reassuring as well. You want to think about the heart. So whenever you do the right heart cath, you can see how high the left-sided pressures are. And sometimes you can have a combination. You can have left-sided heart disease and pulmonary arterial hypertension. That's also very common. Group four, so CTPE does not rule out chronic thromboembolic disease. So you would need a VQ scan. And I think these three steps, if you rule these out very quickly early on, like a CT, which we already have, a right heart cath to check the left-sided disease, and a VQ scan, if you can get the vast majority of cases. And once you rule these out, you can then jump to group one and group five. And I'm not going to delve deeply into these until we get more information from Maddie in the next aliquot. So Maddie, can't wait to hear more.
All right. Well, in this aliquot, I will give you a right heart cath that was repeated during this hospitalization. She'd previously had some as well. But maybe first I'll say, so basically she was admitted, started on IV diuresis. Over the subsequent days, maybe the first day I admitted her, she was initially improving, but then her clinical trajectory worsened and she developed worsening urine output despite increasing diuretic requirements. She was also required inotropic support. Her extremities, when I first saw her in the ED, I did not appreciate them being very cool, but over the subsequent days started having cooler extremities. So basically we were managing her in the ICU for cardiogenic shock from this decompensated right heart failure. So she got a right heart cath, and the right atrial pressure was 18. Normal, you know, you guys can talk about the normal values, but normal being generally less than 6 to 7. Her pulmonary artery pressure, the mean pressure, was 65. Systolic was 95. Diastolic was 50. The pulmonary capillary wedge pressure was 5. That's normal. And then there was a low cardiac output and low cardiac index as well. And the PVR was 23. So kind of the summary of that right heart cath is there was elevated right and normal left filling pressures. There were markedly elevated PA pressures and a reduced cardiac output. I'll maybe pause here and you all can talk about if you think this is what type of pattern. You know, Noah talked about pre-capillary, post-capillary patterns on right heart cath. So maybe Noah, I can pause here and hear your thoughts on that right heart cath.
Yeah, this case gets more and more complex. So before I go into the pattern, just kind of want a brief recap. So we have a patient that now has kind of cardiogenic shock from right ventricular failure with normal left ventricular function in the background of chronic hypoxemic respiratory failure of unknown etiology and with a normal spiro and technically normal gross lung imaging, right? The CTP is not the best at identifying subtle parenchymal changes, but we do have a normal CTP. Going back to the spiro, it's pretty interesting that she has a isolated severe decreased DLCO, and that is an early clue of a vascular problem being present. Other causes of low DLCO would be kind of a restrictive etiology, would also cause a restrictive pattern on a spiro, like ILDs. So I think the DLCO kind of points towards pulmonary hypertension in even in the spirometry. So with the cath, now we have elevated mean pulmonary arterial pressure, which diagnoses this patient as broadly pulmonary hypertension. We have a normal wedge, which basically says that the left-sided pressures are fine, and we have increased resistance. This would be compatible to me to a pre-capillary pulmonary hypertension, so that's how I'm labeling this patient in my mind. What do you think, Yusuf?
I'm right there with you, Noah. So no left-sided heart disease, we're in the capillary. And now the big question, do we have chronic embolic disease or are we going to delve into the other etiologies? And so what are these other etiologies that we're talking about? So in general, you want to think about inflammatory causes and non-inflammatory causes. So inflammatory causes include we talk about the eye made mnemonics, so infections such as like HIV, schistosomiasis, if the patient's from the endemic region, malignancy, like Mark said, so either microthrombi or macrothrombi, which, and in this case, I mean tumor thrombus, and it can cause a TMA as well in the pulmonary vessels. Autoimmune disease, so lupus, scleroderma, mixed connective tissue disease, even sarcoid can cause it as well. And then drug, we don't hear about any drugs here, but thinking about amphetamines, for example, or some chemotherapeutic agents. In terms of non-inflammatory causes, I think of shunt. So if you have like a big shunt physiology, that can be one cause. Thyroid disease is another. And then vitamin deficiencies, such as vitamin C deficiency, which is Mark's favorite disease. And then there are rare etiologies like pulmonary veno-obstructive disease and hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasias. And then there's a genetic component as well, usually presents in a younger patients who have the step one question, which is the bumper to gene mutation, and that causes like pulmonary arterial hypertension. But this patient is older, and then idiopathic, which basically means medicine has not reached a point where we know what causes it. Mark, what would you add to this?
I don't think I would add anything, Yusuf. I think we need to, you know, send those serologies, maybe do a closer exam to see if we're missing any subtle rheumatological clues on the patient's skin or on the patient's joints. And to be honest, you know, as I think Noah mentioned, like CTPs are good, but they're not perfect. To complete the workup, I personally would do a high resolution CT to make sure we're not missing any subtle parenchymal abnormalities. Now, you might say, if a CTP doesn't show any parenchymal abnormalities, it's probably highly unlikely that a high-res CT will show parenchymal abnormalities to the degree that the patient is on 5 liters, right? A CTP, if it's if the hypoxemia is from a pure parenchymal etiology, the CTP will show something, right? But, you know, a high-res CT might show some, again, subtle parenchymal abnormalities that can lead us down a certain diagnostic pathway. Because if this patient has any hint towards ILD, then we really will be running towards the rheumatological bucket, right? But again, I would definitely want to do, you know, a good exam to make sure we're not missing any subtle features, which, again, sometimes are hard to detect. The one thing I just want to highlight, because I love physiology, are two numbers to keep in mind when you're looking at this cath, and could kind of hint you early on that this, you know, in addition to the PVR and the wedge, that, you know, the RV is doing really bad. And a lot of this is driven from solely like RV disease and precapillary disease, as opposed to a mixed picture, is the RV to wedge ratio, right? A normal RV to wedge ratio, like, let's say like a normal RA pressure is about 5. Our normal wedge is about 10, right? So that ratio is about 0.5, the RA to wedge. Now that has completely reversed in this patient, right? This patient's RA pressure is 17. And his patient's wedge is 5. So that reversal shows that the RV is doing really bad, right? Another one to keep an eye on is what's called the pulmonary artery pulsatility index, or the PAPI. It's essentially the stroke volume of the RV. And how you calculate that is you just take the systolic PA pressure of 95 minus the diastolic PA pressure of 50, and then divide that by the RA pressure. And I won't get into the nitty gritties of the numbers, but this patient's PAPI is very bad, which essentially means the stroke volume of the RV is doing really poorly. So that's just some things I've learned at the CCU and some numbers that we would track daily on patients with suspected RV failure. All right, Maddie, please teach us what your team did next.
I love PAPI, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved your localization, Noah. You nailed it, that this was concerning to the team for a pre-capillary pattern. And so just to spell that out as you did, we had a mean PA pressure greater than 20, which was kind of the diagnostic, that's how you diagnose pulmonary hypertension greater than 20. The pulmonary vascular resistance was elevated. I've generally learned the threshold of kind of greater than 2 Woods units. And then the pulmonary capillary pressure was normal. And the threshold that I've learned is less than 15. So all of those were consistent with a pre-capillary pattern. So in terms of what happened next, and maybe I'll kind of answer some of the questions that Mark and Yusuf were asking about in terms of some of the workup that you would send to investigate some of the causes. So kind of going by the WHO groups, so she had a TSH that was normal. Her HIV, hepatitis C serologies were non-reactive, had an ANA, rheumatoid factor, CCP, that was normal. You had mentioned kind of on exam, were there any other signs concerning for autoimmune disease and kind of like joint disease, skin disease, nothing there. Utox was negative. So that's kind of goes into like the group one, WHO group one. For the group two, kind of the left-sided heart disease, which I mentioned the right heart cath, and no other like new workup for that. For the group three, I mentioned the CTPE and the pulmonary function testing, but yeah, never got a high resolution CT scan. So that's for the group three. Group four, for the chronic thromboembolic disease, you know, she did not have a PE on that CT scan, but did not get a VQ scan, you know, this admission. And no specific known risk for the group five category. So, you know, at this point, kind of the summary there was we were concerned about a pre-capillary pattern. There was reduced cardiac output for her. She was requiring increasing amounts of diuretics and inotropes. And based off of those right heart cath findings, the concern was, are we in the WHO group one category, pre-capillary disease? And so at this point, the pulmonary hypertension team brought up the idea of starting a pulmonary vasodilator, specifically epoprostenol. And so, basically the patient's trajectory was worsening at this point. And this was kind of seen as what could possibly help her, because even despite inotropes, diuretics, she was not doing well. So she was started on epoprostenol after kind of discussion of the risks and benefits with the family. And basically, after the administration of epoprostenol, her hemodynamics worsened even further. At this point, I was off the team, but looking through the charts, she continued to decline, and it was an even bigger decline after starting the epoprostenol, the pulmonary artery vasodilator. So I wanted to pause here and get your thoughts on kind of specifically, what do you make of her declining hemodynamics with epoprostenol? Yusuf, maybe I can turn the mic to you.
Yeah, Maddie, thank you for presenting this adequate. One thing that comes to my mind, we're thinking about group one etiologies, and we're thinking of inflammatory versus non-inflammatory symptoms. And here we don't hear about any inflammatory symptoms so far. And under the non-inflammatory bucket, we talked about vitamin deficiencies. We didn't hear about any risk factors. And you can develop scurvy just from like avoiding citrus products. And in this case, we didn't even hear about that. One telltale sign of pulmonary veno-occlusive disease, which is a disease that acts like heart failure, but then once acts like left heart failure, and then when you do the cath, you see that the left-sided pressures are normal, and that is how a pulmonary veno-occlusive disease presents. And one telltale sign is that these patients, sometimes their hemodynamics worsen with epoprostenol or vasodilators, because if you think about it, they're occluded at the venous side, so right after the capillary. So if you vasodilate them, their hemodynamics worsen. So I'm adding that higher on my list. So that's one thing I'm considering. And then would love to hear from Noah and Mark as well as to, could this just be worsening shock? And is this just the right heart spiral that Mark was alluding to earlier? And both are on the differential. So Noah and Mark, would love to hear from you both.
Yeah, I really like the PVOD hypothesis. I was thinking about it before with the diffused LCO and the cryptic hypoxia. It would be the decreased LCO in pulmonary hypertension can be from a problem in diffusion or from reduced blood flow in severe PH. In this case, it seems like the hypoxia predated the PH, and the etiology that causes severe hypoxia is PVOD, because you have disruption of the gas exchange through proliferation of the alveolar membrane. And the classic manifestation of the EPO, it's kind of suggestive. I think it can cause either hemodynamic instability or pulmonary edema. And I'm excited to see what else you have in store for us, Maddie. What about you, Mark? What do you think?
I totally agree. I think this would be a good case for PVOD. And I love your guys' explanation of the pathophysiology. That is the exact same reason why patients with left heart failure and elevated wedge pressure, that's kind of a relative contraindication to pulmonary vasodilators for the same pathophysiology that Yusuf highlighted. It's like, if you have a stiff left heart, and you flood the left heart from pulmonary vasodilation with blood, that's going to get just thrown right back into the lungs. And unfortunately, I actually saw a case of that in the CTU my intern year, when I think the overnight team didn't realize how severe the patient's left heart disease was, even though they had pulmonary hypertension, and they were started on epoprostenol overnight. The patient developed fast pulmonary edema and actually had a hypoxic arrest overnight from that same mechanism. So it's real. And it's definitely something, especially pulmonary hypertension, doctors worry about, and especially with PVOD. PVOD is really interesting. It's also called pulmonary capillary hemangiomatosis, is another term that you'll see in the literature. And there is a heritable form that's, you know, more common in younger patients, but there also is acquired forms. They're definitely not that common, but there's certain like chemotherapies and even like systemic sclerosis, while it can cause group one PAH from the arterial side, it also can cause PVOD as well. And there's also some implications of like HIV, and which again is also associated with on the arterial side for pulmonary hypertension, but also has been associated with PVOD. So I think the age is interesting, but again, there is acquired forms that are non-heritable that definitely can occur in older patients. So I do think it's a good case for PVOD, and that's why going back to the CT scan would be interesting. I know we didn't get a high-res CT scan this patient, but there are some very classic findings with PVOD on CT scans. Classically, they'll have interlobular septal thickening with centrolobular nodules. It almost mimics actually pulmonary edema on a CT scan, but the patient won't have left-sided heart disease. And the other interesting feature too, these patients have like a disruption in their lymphatics and can have some mediastinal lymphadenopathy as well. So the classic triad essentially is mediastinal lymphadenopathy, interlobular septal thickening, and centrolobular nodules. So I would definitely keep a close, I would take a close look if that CTP is available to see if any of those features were at play. But yeah, Manny, tell us, what did you learn? What happened to the patient?
Yeah, first of all, just incredible teaching from all three of you. So I'll talk a little bit about kind of what happened to the patient, and then I'll share a little bit about what I learned about the final diagnosis. So really, her hemodynamics really worsened after the epoprostenol, and despite, you know, kind of everything, her clinical state was worsening. So ultimately, she, her and her family kind of transitioned her to comfort care, and she unfortunately passed away. And the suspicion for what the final diagnosis was exactly as you all suspected, PVOD, pulmonary vaso-occlusive disease. And really, that it was that suspicion based off of the rapid deterioration with the pulmonary vasodilator, and also kind of not having a clear alternative explanation for her pulmonary hypertension. You know, really, you like make that diagnosis when if you kind of basically like look at the lung after someone is deceased, but basically on path, but it just based on kind of how her trajectory went with the pulmonary vasodilators, that's why the suspicion was for PVOD in this case. You all kind of commented, you all taught a lot about it, but I just want to tell you and summarize what I learned about it. So Yusuf mentioned this, but basically in PVOD, you get this fibrotic obstruction of the post-capillary pulmonary veins and venules. But exactly as Mark said, you often also get kind of obstruction of the pulmonary capillaries, and then you get this abnormal proliferation of pulmonary capillaries. So there's, you know, a term PVOD, but then also what Mark said, pulmonary capillary hemangiomatosis. And I was reading about this, and I encourage you all, there's a great NEJM clinical case back in August of this year that is this case, is very, very similar. As I was reading this case, I was like, oh my gosh, that's what very similar to the trajectory of the patient I saw. And in this kind of clinical case discussion, they talk about how PVOD and PCH is kind of seen as like a single disease entity just on a spectrum. But the takeaway is it's a rare form of pulmonary hypertension, but it's very deadly. And exactly based on the pathophysiology that Yusuf mentioned, pulmonary vasodilators cause this worsening because you get dilation of the pulmonary artery, and then basically that enhances flow upstream to the site of obstruction, and then get this life-threatening pulmonary edema. And what's so tricky is that PVOD is so hard to distinguish from PAH. And what's so horrible about that is PAH, you use pulmonary vasodilators as part of that treatment. And in PVOD, these pulmonary vasodilators cause this, you know, life-threatening pulmonary edema, but they are almost indistinguishable on echo findings in terms of the RV dysfunction and the dilation and the elevated kind of tricuspid regurg. And then also the right heart cath findings are the same in PVOD and PAH. You basically get this, you know, elevated pulmonary artery pressure and a normal pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. So they're very hard to distinguish, but the treatments are like, you know, in PAH, the pulmonary vasodilators can be helpful, and in PVOD, they are really not. So that's kind of like the summary of what I learned, but it was a really sad case because of the patient's outcome. But it really kind of prompted me to really do a deep dive into PVOD and learn about pulmonary hypertension, and just loved all of your teaching, and you all were suspicious of the final diagnosis. So curious to hear any thoughts or reflections you have.
Thank you, Maddie, for sharing this patient's story and letting us learn from her case. And I don't think I've seen this diagnosis before. But like you said, think if it's left heart failure, but the numbers don't show left-sided heart disease, then it's probably PVOD. And that's how I remember it.
I love this case, and thank you for bringing it to us. I find PVOD to be one of the most interesting diseases, and my favorite thing ever is going to the ICU to all like the pulmonary hypertension patients or the chronic hypoxemic respiratory failures and say it's PVOD. I think part of it is kind of because it's kind of like a zebra diagnosis, but part of it is because it's like very, it's not very suspected, right? You have to have a pretty high degree of like index of suspicion to even consider that diagnosis. Like you said, it mimics PH pretty well, mimics heart failure pretty well. And those patients, they may have, you know, some HFpEF and you kind of get mislabeled and you're like, oh, it's kind of what Mark said. It's not really that severe of HFpEF, but they're like really sick. And then they get mislabeled and delays in treatment happen and so forth. So I think just bringing it to a bigger audience, making more people aware of it, you're doing many patients a good service, Maddie.
Yeah, sorry about the outcome of your patient, Maddie, but I think honestly PVOD is like the best diagnosis to highlight the workup for pulmonary hypertension because every single algorithm, PVOD evades it. Right, it's like when you look at a right heart cath, like you can't diagnose PVOD on a right heart cath. The serology equals a negative. Every single thing will be negative. So you have to go down the entire algorithm and then realize that like it completely sneaks away from the algorithm. So I think it's a perfect case to highlight this complex disease. So thanks for bringing it to us today.
Yeah, thank you guys. It was a truly phenomenal discussion. Loved your teaching. And yeah, we will end the session there. But thank you all and we'll see you next time.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.